men, those of us being African, all of us Americans. Down here in the state of Alabama, where a white man named Doug Jones needed us more than a white man whose name is Roy Moore. We black women, many of us black men, those of us being African came poor. We came marginalized. We on the fringes of American society without the power of speech, armed only with one vote. We came, Alabama, on election evening. In a fiercely conservative state, a state drenched from the Confederacy, with its history hallmarked by secession, with its vicious races, now comes a new senator, a former prosecutor of four Klansmen, murderers of four young black girls, who will never grow up to be numbered among we black women. Who will never cast a vote for Doug Jones, who will never hear Charles Barkley's advocacy, who will never hear CNN declare Jones victor, who will never read the Washington Post election call, who will never gaze upon the USA Today castigation of Trump, who will never have to listen to Trump's fake congratulation, who will never revel in conservative defeat, who will never know the joy of people doing the right thing. Watch for once Alabama draw close, it close its Venetian blinds. Without black women, the black man would have never survived. Without black women, Alabama might never have survived. Without black women, there'd be no election last evening in Alabama for Doug Jones. No election evening for the arc of the moral universe that bends toward justice. Let us go back to the 16th Street Baptist Church. Let us say yes and amen to the God of redemption. Let us pay homage to four young black girls who will never become black women. Let us weep for the black men they will never bear. Let us march on. Let us shout how victory was won, like it was last night on election evening in Alabama.
I'm glad you were able to write that one and not a even darker one or grimmer one.
Yeah. You know, when you start interweaving history and the struggle of black and brown people. You know, Patrick, I tell people all the time, the civil rights movement had a black and brown face, but it was a multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multi-religious movement. And the civil rights movement would not have been as successful if it were not for the contributions of white people and Jewish people and Asian people. We look at Goodman, Swerner, and Cheney. There was that diversity there. So.
Yeah. No, there was, I mean, it was the, I'm spacing the name, but it was the Civil Rights Summer where they, lots of students went down to the South.
Mm-hmm. A lot of students went.
And yeah, that's part of the struggle. And it's also, I mean, I don't know. I went to a meeting here recently. It's like, I feel like whiteness, race is a construct in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it just... Yeah. It's
well, you know, one of the parts I love about the Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech, I think it's been a while since I've quoted it, but he said, our creative protests must not lead us to distrust all white people.
And I can't remember if that's in there or not, but the thing is, I've always heard, it's been a long time since I've heard the entire speech,
mm-hmm.
and I did read the entire speech a couple months ago. But I don't know. I mean, that was... But I think the thing is that it's almost like... I mean, I grew up Irish-American, so it's a little bit... It's not different. It's just that your ethnicity is different from your race. Like, you get... Whiteness is this thing that gets papered over your ethnicity if you're white. unquote white.
Mm-hmm.
And but I mean the main thing is that it's, I mean, a lot, some of it goes back to Thoreau and not actually. Thoreau was in a prison and he was not paying his taxes to support a war. Excuse me for a second. Mm-hmm. To not support a war. Actually, it was the Mexican War, I believe, in the 1850s. And who was it? One of the other great transcendentalists was on the other side of the jail talking to him. And he was like, why are you in jail? God, after now I'm spacing people's names. Emerson was on the other side and was like, why are you in jail? And Thoreau was like, why are you not in jail? I'm in here because I don't want to stand on other people's rights.
Mm.
And that seems to be, that's what needs to happen is just, and I think Ta-Nehisi, have you read Ta-Nehisi Coates's
Ta-Nehisi Coates, yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry I mispronounced his name. Mm-hmm. His most recent book, the essay about the first white president.
Oh, I haven't read the book, but I read that essay.
Yeah, and that's kind of what's going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, unfortunately, and I don't think we need that right now. I think we need something else.
Well, I got something special tonight before we go. I'll tell you what, it might be apropos if I just go ahead and read the I Have a Dream speech.
Oh, yeah, go for it.
I have it. I'll save it for a little bit later before we go.
Okay, no, definitely.
It's rather lengthy.
I think it's like about 20, 25 minutes, isn't it?
I think I've done it over the years. I think it's somewhere around 12 to 15 minutes.
Okay, as long as we figure it out. We got about 45 minutes, a little under that right
we'll
now.
We'll get in. You know, one of the things I wrote about, you know, in America, America has a history of police violence. And especially in our inner cities, and especially against black and brown people and poor and marginalized folk. And, you know, one of the things I always like to say, you know, not all police, not all law enforcement folk are bad. Many of them noble get up and put their life on the line every day. But then again, you know, there's an element and portion of police force who just violate the code, you know, who tarnish the badge. And it just so happens that, you know, brown and black people and marginalized poor people are usually wind up on the other end of that stick. But I wrote a poem one day about it, and it's called Poor Boy, Poor Boy. And it goes like this. Poor boy felt he had nowhere to turn. When facing a wall higher than I, he thought, concede. Poor boy leaned forward as if it were a wailing wall. Spread all 10 fingers as wide as possible. He prepared expressly for the beatdown in lieu of the policy that required a pat down. I whispered to him that if we awake, inhale as deep as you can, then hold it. For every breath, poor boy, is all you will ever own, it being what little breath is left in your broken body. Poor boy. How many people have just had the life beat out of them, breath beat out of them?
Were you thinking of Eric Garner when you...
Eric Garner is a perfect, you know, perfect as an example of that.
Yeah.
And,
you
know, it just continues. And, you know, at some particular point, the citizenry has to stand up and say enough is enough. I have a son. He's about 29 now. And I got to be honest with you, there's not a day that goes by that I don't think about, is he safe? You know, I think about my daughters are they safe? You know, America has progressed in over 240 years. It seems like, you know, the Constitution talks about, or is it the Constitution says, in order to form, the preamble to the Constitution, in order to form a more perfect union, it just seems like across the states we shouldn't be dealing with, you know, police violence, police injustice.
I think there's, I don't know, I feel like there's several different things going on, and one of them, I think, is that police have a tendency to stop people of color. Mm-hmm. It's probably also class a little bit too. And that sure. If you're not dressed specific way, if you're dressed specific way, you're more likely to get stopped. Mm-hmm. But I think it's that, and I think it's also it's dangerous to be stopped by a police officer. Something can go wrong. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just a lot of it is a militarization of the country as well. And that was something that Dr. King was speaking out about when he was assassinated.
You know, there's an element of, implicit bias. And that's a big area now in the equity, diversity, inclusion movement. And, you know, all of us walk around with some form of bias. But, you know, some of that bias is just... And I got a poem I call... I am not a monster. And I think about it as a black man, I'm acutely aware of many times the perceptions that people have.
Can I just jump in for a second and just state I'm laughing because I told you I'm a monster poet?
Yeah, right.
So I just figured, I mean, those of you who have listened to the show would probably know I do weird stuff with my voice and all that, but.
Well, you might be able to relate to this, but... you know, I think many of us who are black males or good men who, you know, love our wife, and, you know, I've been married 37 years to the same person, and I've raised three outstanding kids, two with advanced degrees, and son is just short of a degree, and they're all just good people, but still sometimes I'm viewed as a monster. But it goes like this: I am not a monster, neither am I fodder for that poster. I am not three-fifths of a man. I am made of spirit, water, and land. I'm not a malefactor, neither one of sin's benefactors. I am not the spawn of devilish men. I am codified a first-class citizen. I am not any man's nigger, neither epithet to be figured. I am not the brother in blazing saddles. I am the mind, if wasted, a terrible matter. I am not little black Sambo. Neither am I covetous of white hoes. I am not the son of Frankenstein. I'm one shade of mankind. I'm not some Al Jolson. Neither am I from prisons like Folsom. I am not a woman beater. I'm an Elohim-fearing believer. I'm not a dope-smoking fool. Neither do I find infidelity cool. I'm not someone to be panned. I am a black man. I am a man. I am a man, I am not a monster.
Like that one.
Yeah, you just gotta. You know, the beautiful thing about poetry for me, Patrick, is the fact that I tell people all the time, I'm so glad that this art form introduced itself to me. You know, as you being a writer, you know, poet, fiction writer, this is the one art form where we can be anything we want to be. I can travel to places in my imagination that my outward appearance or the color of my skin or just my station in life would not allow me to travel. And poetry opens up that portal. And the thing that I love most about poetry is I tell people, I whittle a stick. And you know what I mean. You write, and then you switch words in, you change out words, you shorten stuff, and I feel like a safe cracker too, because you know when you're writing, you know, you're trying to get that click, then you go to the left click until finally, and there's not one one semicolon, one quesera. There's not one enjambment. There's nothing in that poem that you would change. You just open it. And, you know, poetry for me over the last 10 years or so has really just opened up that window for me.
Yeah, I have to say I'm not completely like that. I know other poets. I know poets who, I mean, I have done that with poems, but I have a tendency to write it and then I let it sit and then I go back to it and I make the cuts. But I know other people like go through like 20 edits on something. And you carve everything off that doesn't need to be there. And it's.
Yeah, I call it whittling the stick. It's like sitting on a porch with a stick and a knife and just trimming it and just, you know, metaphoric. I've got a poem. I've got quite a few poems I want to share tonight, what we can do within the time that we have. But, you know, sometimes it's just, you know, I am not a monster, but sometimes it's just the perception, you know, sometimes of black males. And sometimes we're perceived erroneously even by the black female. And so I wrote a poem called As If That Wasn't Obvious. Listen to this. I smiled at a black woman, only she refused in kind. I'm black, as if that wasn't obvious. She understood my gesture. It was not her first time, and certainly not my last. I smiled at a white woman, only she refused in kind. I am a man. As if that wasn't obvious. Maybe she misunderstood my gesture. It was not her first time, and certainly not my last. Each time I smiled at myself, only to do so in kind. I'm a black man, as if that wasn't obvious. I took pride in my gestures. It was not my first time, and certainly not my last.
I like that one.
Thank you.
That's like a Villanelle.
Yeah, it's close.
It's yeah.
I
the repeating lines in the.
just trying to, you know, I think that's the beauty of poetry for many of us who are poets. Sometimes we work things out, you know, just because you see a woman who's, you know, is dressed real nice and looks good doesn't mean that you're interested in her. You're just looking because you love the way that she combinated her, maybe her professional outfit, you know, and stuff like that. But, you know, ironically, it is the world that we live in. And there are a lot of good men out there. There are a lot of good men, a lot of noble men who are both black, white, people of color. I was in high school. And I had a history teacher, and I won't call his name. He's a really good history teacher. But he had his own internal biases that he wasn't aware of. And it was my senior year. And I ran into him. He saw my name somewhere about 3 years ago. We got together for lunch. And he still remembers this incident that I wrote this poem about. And it'd be neat if he was listening. It's called Prejudice and Epiphany. His students let fly his use of the terminology colored people. It was historic given he's our U.S. history teacher. Of course, I didn't. His teaching... his story. Me being a person of color, heaven forbid of colored people origin, as if scribbled with Crayola in a coloring book. Strange his pedagogy, given I, the lone sprout, being of abstract ethnicity and his of concrete certainty, hence my objection. What color were they? the silence epic. His epiphany calculating. I'm known for such revelatory utterances. Repercussions, instant indignation. At that moment, I became the teacher. He found enlightening my pedagogy. Knowledge misapplied is best amended from within rather than without. Unconscious bias has been his people's bread. Breadcrumbs dispersed upon the path leading to prejudice and privilege. He sees more clearly now. He knows me as a person of color, not as a colored person. Don't worry. You'll experience the epiphany. Yeah, there's a difference between being called a person of color and a colored person.
Yeah.
We know how colored people was used.
I like the breadcrumbs.
Yeah.
Remind me of Hansel and Gretel.
Well, sometimes epiphanies comes in terms of, in the form of breadcrumbs. I got one called political dissent. Political dissent. Maybe we could talk a little bit about this one. It's not very long. Political dissent. First, my pencil. Then, writing paper. With my blood. I wrote on these walls. Only to be made to wash them daily. I scratched on every wall, I scratched. Until they replaced every wall with iron bars. I see more clearly now. Scratching long verse on these open walls between these iron bars with my dissident mind. What that poem is talking about there, it's when we can grasp stuff, with our cognitive ability. A lot of stuff is written in paper. A lot of stuff is scribbled on walls and scribbled on stone. But when we can make that cognitive, transference, when we can intuit, concepts, that's when they alter our personality, alter our character.
We can bring them into ourselves.
Absolutely.
Instead of just being on a piece of paper that we don't really notice.
Absolutely. Until people internalize stuff. That's why people say, sometimes, spoken word is really great too, because, you have to memorize it. Most times you're required, and especially in slams, it usually works better if you can memorize it.
I don't think they let people, I think at this point, if you're reading off a paper, it's a prop.
Well,
I can't remember what the Nationals were like.
I think some slams, the only thing they'll let you use is read off paper or phone. But I think in a more serious competition, it would be probably constitute a prop.
I just remember there being like controversy about what constitutes a prop for a long time. So
true confession. I was at the Portland Poetry Slam. I'd heard about it. And so I went downtown to Backspace for the Portland Poetry Slam. And they had open mic, and I got in it. And I delivered my poem, rocked the house. It was great. Then I saw this little buzzing going around, this talking. And they came up to me and said, you committed a prop violation. I didn't know what a prop violation was.
So they don't allow props in the open mic? Or they didn't? Because Backspace isn't no more, unfortunately.
Right, correct. They don't meet
there. But I remember when they had the open the poetry slams there.
Well, what they did was they would have open mic, then a feature, and then what they would do is they'd have two people who would actually go against each other just to show the audience how it would work.
The sacrificials.
Sacrificial lambs.
Yeah.
So it was my first time in a spoken word situation. I was part of the sacrificial lamb. So I think the other person went first. I went second. I killed it. And then they come and say, well, you had a prop violation. Because the poem that I did, I had a black girl stand up. And I recited to the, she was the object of what I recited.
Wow.
And, okay. And it wound up, they had to debate it. But it was a prop violation. And so my introduction to spoken word poetry was a prop violation. I said, wow.
Yeah.
Man, let me mention something real quick. You know, one of the things that I worry a little bit about in poetry is that sometimes, you know, some of our younger poets, they want to talk about revolution, you know, and that kind of stuff. And you know, anybody could write about anything and they could be pretty passionate about it. But revolution is a real thing. People die in revolutions. Sometimes I see people get so worked up, you know, tears, and they're angry. And sometimes I wonder, I said, have you ever taken a bullet in a revolution? So, you know, sometimes I get a little concerned when we take it too far. But I wrote this poem called Revolution, and it goes like this. Of revolution there was once talk, boisterous talk, by ignorant braggarts, romancing revolution, who knew nothing of bloodshed, of torn flesh and limb, of disfigurement and death. The more they bragged, the more boisterous they became. They are the romantically inclined, whose imagination glorifies the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, the slicing with bayonet-mounted knives, the hand over a mouth that snuffs out a life in these, the eyes of the romantically inclined. Fools romanticize revolution. But I say, just kill them all.
That's kind of a nihilistic end. I love that you're having fun with it, though. But I hear that, and they're not. They need to read more history, and it's not pleasant. Yeah. But
it's tough.
No.
You know, why don't I do Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech?
Cool. That'd be great.
And then if we have a little time left over,
we
could check. Because I think we just got an hour tonight.
Yeah, we...
I happened to put it on... I'm glad I brought my iPad, because I have it here on my iPad. I keep it with me. Usually when I've done it in the past, and I've done it for 30 years. But you know what's interesting? Since Barack Obama's election, no one has asked me to come and do the I Have a Dream speech. I told my wife tonight, it just
really ended.
Yeah, since his election. I imagine somebody does it somewhere around the country, but I used to do it 3 or 4 times every year. So yeah. I won't try to capture his voice inflection tonight, but I'll read it. I Have a Dream by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. 50 years ago, a great American, in whose symbolic shadow we stand today, signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, this Negro is still not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still badly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro is still languishing in the corners of American society and finds himself an exile in his own land. So we have come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, We have come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men, as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. So we have come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summer of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until there's an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who had hoped that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will neither be rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But there is something I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the place of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protests to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to distrust all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is inextricably tied to our destiny. They have come to realize that their freedom is bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. As we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied as long as our bodies, heavy with the fatigue of travel, can I gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the cities? We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one. We can never be satisfied as long as our children are stripped of their selfhood and robbed of their dignity by signs stating for whites only. We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No. No, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by storms of persecution and staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friends, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious races, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and little black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and little white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. Every hill and every mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we'll be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we'll be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning. My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and every molehill of Mississippi. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And when this happens, we'll allow freedom to ring. When we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last." I Have a Dream by Dr. Martin.
That was awesome. Thank you. And I was totally wrong. Yeah, you were right. Yeah. You were right about that part.
Yeah.
I don't know why I blocked it out.
No, it happens. Let me close with just one more poem. We've got a few minutes, and maybe we could just kind of discuss. I incorporated something from one of Langston Hughes' work. I think you played it earlier, "I Too Am America." But it's called, I call this poem, "An Unremarkable Negro." And of course, I'm Negro, and I'm a poet. And I don't know if I'm remarkable yet, but in the world of poetry, but my pedigree is growing around the world with regard to poetry. But I just wrote a poem that I thought really reflected on humility in the few minutes we have left. It's called an Unremarkable Negro. To the Negro, history has not been kind. If this Negro's history is his story, follow the line that precedes me. Follow that unimaginable journey from humanity to inhumanity, from dignity to indignity, and yet, from the grave, Langston Hughes shouts, "I too am America." From the grave, James Baldwin shouts, "I am not your Negro." From the grave, Maya Angelou shouts, "Still, I rise," while I, Emmett Wheatfall, an unremarkable Negro, a Negro of continuing origin, a Negro following the line that precedes me, to whom history has not been kind. An unremarkable Negro.
I like that.
Yeah, man. You know, I think in the poetic world, there have just been some great, great you know, people of color. I think of Phyllis Wheatley, you know, she was back around when this nation was being founded. She was a slave, and she learned from the Wheatleys how to write. And she was one of the first Africans in this country to be published, Phyllis Wheatley. I, you know, what comes to mind is greats like some of the more modern, you know, Nikki Giovanni. And
I actually borrowed a CD of Nikki Giovanni I was going to play. Mm. I don't, perhaps you know this one, though. Mm. Unfortunately, I was listening to it. I do like her poetry, but there's a lot of gospel music. Like, there'll be a poem, and then it starts into turns.
Oh, it turns into gospel.
It turns into a gospel song, and I was like, but I was originally going to put that on at one point. But
yeah, you know, but, great poets like Derek Walcott, he just passed not too long ago. It's just brilliant. And of course, Maya Angelou, would be remiss if I didn't mention her. People like Lucille Clifton and Audre Lorde, and you know, just so many great, great poets. And
Yusuf Kaminyaka?
Yes, yes, yes. And, you know, one of the things I want to mention, you know, I'm doing a lot of lyrical poetry. What I mean by lyrical poetry is poetry to music. And I try to tell people all the time, you know, poetry is one of our first art forms. And you and I both know the troubadours and the bards went from countryside with a mandolin.
Well, even before that, it's Sappho. I mean, it's Homer versus Sappho. Homer,
yeah, Socrates.
Socrates was a little bit like Jesus, and he walked around and told people stuff, and someone else wrote it down.
For sure.
whereas Homer, I mean, who knows who Homer actually was, but... Homer was the epic writer, and Sappho was not that long after, and was writing. And there are others around the same time too. There's I can't remember his name, but the guy who actually wrote the epitaph for Leonidas that's at where the 300 happened at the Thermopylae. Lyric poetry's been around for a long, long, long time, and it's.
I'm really hoping that, you know, out here in the Northwest that some of these poets can start taking their spoken word and, putting it to music. You know, again, it comes to mind, you know, back in the beat era poets, you know, Kerouac and, you know, some of these other folks, these people did poetry to music. And, I'm hoping that we could see more folks that'll do it at a professional
level. But you've been doing that. Do you have any readings coming up with musicians or any readings coming up?
I'll be at the Beaverton Library on April 7th. It's free. Beaverton Library, April 7th. And I'm going to be doing lyrical poetry. I've got some of Oregon's best musicians. Got King Louis Payne on the B3 Hammond. He's going to be playing. Edwin Coleman III, he's a legend, lying in Portland, playing the drums. Renato Caranto, he not too long ago, he was on the road, I think, with Merle Haggard. So a lot of these guys I've performed with before in the past, so they're going to be backing me up for an hour set out at the Beaverton Library at 2 o'clock on
That's awesome.
April 7th. So
yeah.
It's free. Yeah. So if anybody wants to come out and get some lyrical poetry... I tell people I don't do rap. I'm too old. You'll never catch me in a hip-hop joint. I'm not dropping no mic. But I do happen to think that, you know, I want people to know that, well, that's rap. No, poetry, lyrical poetry was long before rap. You know, rap does a lot of turn on rhyme. There's just a lot of sequencing of rhyme.
Well, it's also, I mean, it's the cadence and the beat sort of, too. It's, I mean, but yeah, it's...
I tell people lyrical poetry, sometimes there may not be a lot of, or hardly any rhyme. And I tell people, I'm a bird on a wire. Of all the instruments, my voice is an instrument. I have to start at A. I don't get, you know, verse A, verse B, bridge, you know, verse C, verse D, bridge, then hook.
Yeah.
Maybe, no, I got to start with word A, and I got to go all the way through that poem to Z, and I got to keep that in time. And I'm the only one probably that if I lose that timing, it's going to be, everybody's going to know it. And to be able to do that, but it's not that hard. If you get a set rhythm, you know, as a matter of fact, when you look at a sonnet, you know, a sonnet, generally most of them are written in iambic pentameter.
Yeah.
And, you know, the line will have, five foots, you know, stress on two of the foots. It's getting a little complicated, a little technical.
No, it's
14
fine.
Lines, you know.
It's always good to talk scansion on talking.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't do it enough.
And so where are you putting the stress? But, you know, you look at Shakespeare's work. You know, I played Othello in college. I could take one of his soliloquies, "Her father loved me, often invited me, still questioned me the story of my life from year to year. I ran it through from my boyish days." You can actually stick that in a timing, in a cadence, and it will work because people don't understand that poetry is musical. As you know, we have notes. You're going to use an enjambment. You know, you're going to use a macron or a breve. You know, and that's the beauty of what we do.
Well, so we only have about 50 seconds. Although I am, well, I do know the Gremlin time is here, so I think I'd see him somewhere in the... No, he's not there. But I think we're going to go out with Langston Hughes again to make a good segue. And
I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers.
So we just have a little bit more time. I wanted to thank our guest tonight, Emmett Weefall. Thank you for your performance tonight and helping us celebrate Dr. King's birthday. Gremlin time is going to be in just a second. I just got to cue it up, but I'd like to thank you. Thank you, Mr. Weefall, again. And everyone, if you can, go to the Beaverton Library on April 7th.
Yeah, 2:00. Be great. Love to see everybody.